Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum. Here on the Aerospace Advantage, we speak with leaders in the DoD, industry, and other subject matter experts to explore the intersection of strategy, operational concepts, technology, and policy when it comes to air and space power. So if you like learning about aerospace power, you are in the right place. To our regular listeners, welcome back. And if it's your first time here, thank you so much for joining us. As a reminder, if you like what you're hearing today, do us a favor and follow our show. Please give us a like and leave a comment so that we can keep charting the trajectories that matter to you most. Today, we are excited to talk about space electronic warfare. It is a game changer impacting missions on orbit and back here on Earth. Current space operations rely on cyber and the electromagnetic spectrum to pass vital information to and from satellites. This is true for all military space operations today. Space professionals regularly talk about the three elements of space operation as ground, satellite, and link. This includes communications, precise navigation and timing signals, what we call PNT, from GPS, downlink of intelligence and missile warning data, basically everything that we use. The United States and potential adversaries have developed electromagnetic warfare means to deny transmitting data in this key link. We're seeing Russia employ these types of weapons in their invasion of Ukraine. So understanding the importance of space electronic warfare, the threats, and countermeasures is absolutely critical for successfully engaging in any future conflict, especially peer fights. Electronic warfare isn't new. It dates back to World War II's Battle of Britain and the U.S. Allied bombing raids over Europe. The Allied radar countermeasure operators used the codename Ravens to employ receivers and transmitters to monitor and jam threat frequencies. Military jargon later changed Ravens to Crows. Since that time, the defense of and maneuver within the electromagnetic spectrum has been undertaken by Crows across the military, government, industrial base, and academia. Back in 1964, these EW professionals established an organization called the Association of Old Crows to focus on electronic warfare, or EW, electromagnetic spectrum operations, EMSO, cyber electromagnetic activities, CEMA, information operations, IO, and other information-related capabilities. They're the gold standard when it comes to all things EW, so when the old crows recognize Guardians, it's a big deal. And that's exactly what happened at the end of 2023, during their annual awards. We are here to chat with some of those distinguished awardees. I am excited to introduce Colonel Christopher Trigger Fernangle. He received the Joseph W. Kearney Pioneer Award. So Trigger, congratulations and welcome to the Aerospace Advantage.
Thanks, Slick. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, we are thrilled to have you. And we're also very excited to introduce Lieutenant Colonel Gene Shocker Adams. He's the commander of the 527th Space Aggressor Squadron. That's right, Space Aggressor Squadron. Really amazing unit. And the 527th won the Outstanding Unit Award. So Shocker, congratulations and welcome.
Hey, thanks, Slick. Thanks for having me today.
Well, and finally, no stranger to the Aerospace Advantage. We have our very own Charles Galbraith, our space expert here at Mitchell. So Charles, welcome back.
Thanks, Slick. Always great to be with you. And hi to Trigger and Shocker. Great to have you with us.
Man, I tell you, I am really fired up and I just want to dive right in. So Trigger, I want to get started with you. What led to your selection for the Pioneer Award? I've got to ask you that first and foremost.
Well, frankly, I just had the good fortune of being the commander for Delta III. So in the Space Force, Space Delta III does electromagnetic warfare for the nation. I got to lead a little north of 400 EW professionals across four squadrons. Three of them were operational and one was training. And they achieved a lot of things in the 2023 timeframe as well as 2022. But I just want to hit on a couple things as far as highlights. The first thing the team did was to put together a quick reaction capability for the nation, for EW, to be able to quickly answer the call of our nation and our coalition partners to do site surveys, to do operational prep of the environment, and to deploy for 30 days until our traditional formations could get there. So that was a team built up of EW professionals across Air Force and Space Force specialty codes that could go out in austere locations with the right gear and organized, trained, and equipped to do that mission. The second thing I'd like to highlight is the ability for us to stand up an electromagnetic warfare ops course. And that is outside the great work that Space Delta One was doing through their initial training and the National Space Security Space Institute with their training. And it was really a top-off training before they went to mission qualifications. And what that allowed us to do is at the unclassified level, give people sets and reps to understand how to move and maneuver within the EMS and be ready at a more functional level for their weapon system training. And then finally, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the mission growth during that year. We went from 4 to 7 expeditionary deployment locations, supporting 5 different combat commands. So at any given time, about a fourth of our formations were deployed. And, you know, with that math, about half were gone, either deployed, employing the system, or in spin-up training.
Yeah, well, outstanding work. And again, congratulations on that award. And Shocker, I want to bring in here as well, because the 527th has been integrating these types of threats that we're expecting to see from adversaries into exercises and training events for over 2 decades. So what does it mean to you and, of course, the men and women of your unit to be recognized with the Outstanding Unit Award?
Oh, it's an absolute honor. And it's an honor for me to serve as the commander of the 527th Space Aggressor. Like, you know, like I tell a lot of folks, I don't think there's a higher form of life on Earth than a Space Force Space Aggressor. So it's an honor for me to serve in that capacity. As you mentioned, for over 20 years, we've been doing the GPS and the SATCOM EA mission. I think what really sets our folks apart is the ability to impact across the entire Department of Defense and with our partner nations. For example, we had about 32 exercises last year, 30 teach missions impacting over 100,000 joint warfighters across the Army, the Marines, the Navy, Guardians, and partner nation forces. So just for the small number of folks we have, which I'll say is right around 50 at any given time, that's a huge impact across the entire Department of Defense and our partner nations.
Well, Trigger and Shocker, I tried to paint the picture regarding the EW operational realities we need to consider in space. So can you each paint the picture for how you see things from, you know, a challenges and opportunities perspectives in the mission? Obviously, space EW is a useful tool for us, but we need to ensure that we defend our own assets from those sorts of attacks. Like anything, being effective demands a strong offense and defense. So let's get started with Trigger first, please.
Well, I think it's important to look at space-enabled attack from an adversary perspective for our ability to influence the kill chain. So whether it be EW from attack, support, or protection perspective, that we look through the lens of investing in capabilities we need to counter that threat, to protect our joint force from the space-enabled attacks, and then we also train our forces for that relevant and realistic threat environment they'll face.
Absolutely. Well, like Colonel Fernangel just said, we need to train for that event, right? And that's what the aggressors bring to this fight, is the ability to be the sparring partner for blue forces with regard to EW. And that's on both sides, right? So we have our traditional SATCOM EA mission that we've talked about, that we've been doing for about 20 years. And that allows the users of SATCOM, or more recently through our Crimson Star exercise, the Delta 8 operators of those systems, to practice identifying, characterizing, and mitigating that type of electronic attack. And then on the opposite side, when we work with Colonel Fernangel's folks when he was a Delta 3, we have a mission area called Adversary SATCOM Network, where our own EW folks will practice their TTPs, and we will respond as the thinking adversary to those types of attacks. So you get those types of reps, and as General Morris Starcom said once, it's better to lose 100 times against the aggressors than once against a near peer adversary, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And I have to say thank you to both of you for making the time, and really just proud of what the Aerospace Advantage is doing. You know, the level of folks that we have engaging on our show has just been incredible. Like, you know, current commanders and leaders like yourselves. And I really have to hand it to Charles for making the connection and getting the right folks to discuss the topics that are impacting our national security at the highest level. And, you know, Charles, in your last counterspace paper, you not only talked about EW threats, but also you know, EW as a means to disrupt adversary space-enabled attacks on our forces. So what makes EW for space so appealing?
Yeah, Slick. So every satellite system that we have relies on that link for its communications, the commanding and controlling from the ground up to the satellite, and then the transmission of the data coming from that satellite back to the end users. And so if there's a way to disrupt or to deny or to do something else to that signal, it's a vulnerability that virtually every space capability would have. And so when you couple that with the desire to conduct operations that are responsible, that don't create long-lived debris. A temporary effect that can be achieved through electronic warfare is an ideal choice. And so that's why I think what Trigger and Shocker are doing and the entire EW community is doing on the space side is so important.
Well, Trigger and Shocker, this question is, you know, one of the perennial criticisms of space operations is high levels of classification. We talked about that, gosh, for almost the last 4 years on the Aerospace Advantage. And, you know, I mentioned it in the intro, EW isn't new, and other domains also have EW capabilities. So what have you seen in your time as space EW experts when it comes to lowering classification and integrating with other domains into joint operations, just so that security doesn't become a limiting factor for folks to work together?
Yeah, what we're seeing at the Pentagon staff level is the work that Dr. Plum and his team is doing on OSD space policy staff to direct changes to declassify where it makes sense, as far as a conceal and reveal strategy. I also saw that personally in the 2016 timeframe when I took command of the 4th Space Control Squadron, now the 4th Electromagnetic Warfare Squadron. When I took over, everything was behind the green door at the top secret special access program level. And even in my short duration as commander over those 2 years, we saw much of the capability go from that top secret SAP level down to the collateral level, whether that be secret or top secret. That also enabled us to share more as far as partnership with coalition partners that have similar type capabilities or want to partner in the joint fires.
From an approvals process perspective, we've seen a positive movement in the delegation of counter space approval activity packages that were formally signed off at the SECDEF level, now delegated down to the O6 level in most cases. As Colonel Fernando alluded to, I've also seen an increase in partner nation participation in a lot of our events. For example, we recently conducted an exercise called Heavy Rain, where we taught UK and Australian forces, as well as we had French participants in that event as well.
Yeah, well, it's great to hear that there have been some changes to really knock that down. I mean, to go from, you know, I think you said SECDEF level down to an O6, that's a big movement. Are there other additional steps that we should be taking from a policy perspective, in your opinion?
Absolutely. I would say that it's important for us not to take our foot off the pedal as it relates to policy concerns and considerations as we bring on more coalition partners and allies, so we can build a more holistic capability and capacity across the EW enterprise.
Yeah, I think Colonel Fernandez spot on with that. And I would just add, you know, there's also the value in strategic deterrence, and it would be difficult to deter without the appropriate messaging. So I think as we demonstrate some of our events and folks have the opportunity to see some of our sparring sessions with Blue from the aggressor perspective, that can send a message, right? I think that's important. Also, from an aggressor perspective, as we start to modernize our replication capabilities, it'll be important to have that kind of empowered mindset going forward. Like we've talked about before, our traditional SATCOM and GPS mission areas, as well as adversary satellite network. But our job as the aggressors is to replicate RED capabilities. And right now, that's a small portion of what those folks could bring to bear. So as we look at other mission capabilities, those types of approvals and those types of classification levels that allow us to send the strategic message and to work more closely with our partner nations will only make us much more proficient and effective.
Yeah, you know, it sounds like there's a compounding sort of set of circumstances at play here. On the one hand, when we decrease classification levels, we're more likely to integrate them into joint operations and to allied operations, which will make us more effective should we ever go to conflict. That also helps strengthen the deterrent messaging that we send to our potential adversaries, that we have this robust integrated deterrent capability, not just with ourselves, but with the joint force and our allies and partners. And then on top of that, well, we're able to integrate that into exercises and training programs so that we're even more proficient should we ever have to go to conflict. So it's like this compounding on top of each other, you know, multiplying the net effect of lowering the classification to increase our overall deterrence by, you know, maybe a factor of three.
Yeah, I could not I couldn't agree more, Charles. It's a great point. And I think that, again, the second, third order effects out of lowering the classification level is what everybody's been asking for a long time, frankly, I think. But, you know, I want to shift the conversation a little bit and talk about organizations. You know, in the Space Force sit up, we saw some consolidation of capabilities, prior Air Force units and missions primarily, but also former Army and Navy personnel and units as well. So we're also seeing new organization changes coming up from the Department of the Air Force as part of the pivot to the great power competition. So where does Space EW fit into this picture?
Well, as you noted, as we brought on those soldiers, sailors, and airmen into the Space Force, we really gained a diversity of thought built on experience and education. And that's really important as we identify and build that culture and identity of guardians in the future for the next fight. As we relate it to Space EW, we just need to normalize it. That's my personal opinion. And as we normalize EW into all domain fires, whether that be from a ship, ground, air, or space-based, that we are able to integrate and synchronize those fires for effect. As we brought on new units, like you hinted at, we brought on operational units that do EW in the protect and defend mission for the space domain, as well as between ground-based and space-based systems to make sure that the adversary doesn't have that benefit of space-enabled attack. Also importantly, we brought on quite a few operational intelligence and cyberspace capabilities. And that's important as we build out targeting folders, as we build out the operational prep of the environment of what's needed, and also so we defend our weapon systems with the soft underbelly of space operations being cyber.
Well, yeah, it is really massively interesting. You know, at the end of the day, it's all about delivering the right effect or preventing the adversary from achieving their desired effect. So in your experiences, what lessons have you learned about integrating space EW effects into joint operations?
Yeah, so this is Shocker. Like I mentioned, at the Aggressors, we support just a plethora of different exercises across the Department of Defense. So, and we also are made up, I don't know if you know this, of folks from different services that are actually in our squadron, which I think is unique at the squadron level, right? So we have a Marine detachment of 5 Marines in our squadron. We have 4 active duty Navy personnel, as well as 12 contractors supporting the COMP2X, the pre-deployment certifications for carrier strike groups. And then we still have some remaining airmen left in the squadron. So we have a pretty joint feel in our squadron. And what we see when we go out and conduct operations is folks that we have to meet where we're at, where they're barely spectrally aware, identifying and characterizing the interference as hostile versus basically blue force, unintentional EMI, fraternization is a first step. And then how you report and mitigate that is another step. Or if we talk to folks like Colonel Fornangle's former troops in Delta 3, it's much more of a crosstalk. And we learn, I would say, just as much from them as they learn from us. It's very mutually beneficial. I don't know if that completely answers your question, but we just see a pretty wide difference in need and how competent folks are. And then we want to meet them where they're at and get them up to very proficient.
Yeah, I think it's also important to note that while space is unique, it's not special. So space electromagnetic attack is no different in a lot of ways than any other forms across the different terrains and different domains of electromagnetic attack. And there's certainly elements across joint forces that are responsible for integrating and synchronizing operations. If you look at the different MSO cells within the combatant commands, the 11 different combatant commands, kind of under the auspices of executing alignment under the STRATCOM lead, but also most combatant commands of the 11 have joint fires elements. And so they're responsible for working with the joint targeting team, the operational units, and building targeting folders responsible for executing fires. And that could be on the attack or the support side. But there are those professionals that are integrated in across different echelons of combatant commands that are doing that alignment, integration, and synchronization.
Yeah, if I could just add to that as well, that's one effort that we're making in the 527th is to take some of these exercises, like I mentioned COMP2X, right? red flag, RECOC that's focused on the UABs. There's a number of single service focused exercises that we support. And we think that anytime we can bring guardians into those events and break down those stovepipes and open up communication between those joint force warfighter partners, we think that's value added. So a small vignette of that might be, let's say that our aggressors are performing SATCOM EA on a carrier strike group that's about to deploy. Well, there's no reason that folks from Delta 3 couldn't geolocate where we're at and get some practice in doing that. And folks from Delta 8 couldn't try to mitigate that EMI, right? So we just need to be more deliberate about finding those opportunities to bring more of these partners together in practice before we have to do it in the real world.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And we're really pressing forward with far more disaggregated space capabilities with things like small sat constellations. And you know, this obviously has a lot of benefits from a resilience perspective, but it's also involved a far more networked force. So that presents the risk tied to comms disruption. So how are you looking at defending against these threats?
Well, as you noted, the joint forces reliant on that satellite communication ability. And it's really important to look at that from a vulnerability standpoint. And really there's three forms of that. You've got the spacecraft or the satellite providing that satellite communication. You have the link and you have the ground station. And if you don't have protection of all three of those elements, the whole structure is at risk. And so as we look at disaggregation, whether it be a proliferated LEO or having relay satellites in GEO or having enhanced by quantum computing encryption, you got to look at all those elements. We saw in the Ukrainian-Russian conflict that Russians came out publicly and said that whether it be a commercial or military satellite, if it's supporting Ukrainian operations, it's a valid military. That's the first step that I've actually witnessed where the sovereign government has said that a commercial target is valid. So as we know that information and what our pacing threats and competitors are looking at, it's more and more important that we design these redundant and these resilient comm architectures that enable the joint force to fight through that disruption.
Absolutely. And I know on the aggressor side, to try to prepare our blue forces to do that, we've talked a little bit already about our SATCOM EA and our adversary SATCOM network approaches to training our blue forces. Recently, within the last few years, we also had our cyber aggressors have stood up that provide a different, I think, modality to protecting those links. And I will take a second to brag on those folks, because we started talking about the AOC Unit of the Year Award, which we're excited about. Those folks were the Space Force Cyber Unit of the Year as well, the cyber aggressors in the 527th. And then we also just found out that we won the Vern Orr Award, which talks about a pretty sparsely resourced units having a huge impact across the DoD. So between our EW aggressors and our cyber aggressors, I think we're poised very nicely to prepare blue forces for the threat that you mentioned.
Well, absolutely. It definitely sounds like it. You guys are really crushing it and doing great work. I have to ask you this. Now, the Army recently announced that they established their own space EW capabilities to push down operational and maneuvering forces. So does that complicate planning of integrated effects?
Hey, Slick, so let me jump in on this one. And I'm interested to hear what Shocker and Trigger have to say about this as well. But it really struck me as odd. As we mentioned, we just transferred a whole bunch of units, including space EW units from the Army and the Navy and others into the Space Force. And so to have the Army turn right around and say, well, you know what, we're going to recreate something, that strikes me as odd. Why couldn't the Space Force deliver that set of capabilities back to the Army and the way we see, you know, other cross domain and cross service support activities like we've done base defense. The Army does base defense for the Air Force. So I really wonder why the Army felt the need to do this. Now, your question about does this complicate integration? I think anytime you get multiple sort of cooks in the kitchen, it's going to complicate some of the planning. I'm not saying it's impossible. Certainly a JFAC is able to integrate all sorts of air capabilities into an effective military operation. And so I think the same can be said for space. And it's really going to be crucial, because if you achieve an EW effect in space, you don't know if it's going to be just localized or if there's going to be users around the world that could be affected by this. And so having that level of coordination at U.S. Space Command, I think, is going to be really critical. But again, I'm really interested to hear what Shocker and Trigger have to say.
Well, it certainly complicates coordination. So there's a couple of other things going on in the background. My understanding is the Army is trending away from the functional area 40s, FA-40s, to an actual branch of space operations experts. And so their purpose for that is a couple-fold, missile defense, missile warning, as well as EW fires. And so as they integrate these multi-domain task forces, the onus is really going to be at the operational level of command and control to do this deconfliction and integration. What we're seeing also on the command side and also some of the component levels is we've got on the U.S. Spacecom side, we've got joint integrated space teams. And on the Space Force side, each command, we're trending and they already have a couple, INOPACOM being one, CENTCOM being another, EUCOM, AFRICOM, where they have space components under that command. And so when we're talking about how do you do the integration, because you've got Space Force units, you've got Army units, you have some other units, all doing fires, all doing similar protect and defend against space-enabled attack, enabling freedom of action for terrestrial forces and things of that nature. So what you really need to be careful of, if you don't have the right network to do that coordination and synchronization, is fratricide. So fratricide in the EMS is obviously a huge concern. We don't want to lock out our own personnel, whether that be DOD or IC personnel. And so the risk with multi-domain task force, if it's not properly coordinated at that kind of operational C2 element and deconflicted, could really impact operations in a negative. The flip side is, if it is integrated at the appropriate level, and we all know that COMREL is always a significant challenge, it could benefit by providing capacity where the Space Force units need more. But you know, from a capability standpoint, pretty similar for what they want to do.
And I would just add from an aggressor perspective, that this question just highlights the importance of what we talked about earlier with regard to integrated training. So one of the ways I think we as aggressors can help to mitigate some of the confusion that has been discussed is through every opportunity that we have to bring those joint force partners together as we practice these effects is better, more reps and sets for them to be used to working together. I think it was Charles who mentioned, you know, kind of the precedence in air, right? We know that if we look in for like close air support, for example, it was not uncommon for the Army or the Marine Corps to retain some CAS capability. We have to be very deliberate then about that integration. I think one of the ways as aggressors we can help do that is just, again, those reps and sets to get those folks practice working together.
Well, Charles, you said something interesting there. And, you know, the Air Force learned this lesson in Vietnam and began cross-filling inter-service personnel with jobs like ground liaison officers from the Army with Air Force units. And I know a lot of folks know about ALOs, air liaison officers working with the Army. So do you think the Space Force needs a space liaison officer or a SLO to advise, you know, Army elements or something like that?
You know, it's interesting to hear Shocker and Trigger talk about this. It sounds like there is already some level of expertise there, but understanding that deconfliction and making sure that those units that might be mobile, that require comm support or jamming, making sure that they know what tools are available to them and they're not necessarily on their back, but they might be via a radio for some guy over the hill that comes and wears a Guardian uniform. Having them understand that up front and you know, as Shocker said, get those reps and sets in training and exercising, that is the first step. If at some point the complications get too great in the level of integration, maybe a space liaison officer to an Army unit is appropriate. But you know, I've just scratched my head when we're standing up a new service to focus on space, when the other services begin to reestablish their own space capabilities. I mean, we all know that the Army has more aircraft than the Air Force and more ships or boats than the Navy. So the decisions that were made back in 1947 out of parochialism, do we have to repeat that? Let's have our integrated capability be within the Space Force. But that's just my soapbox.
Well, in addition to the Army, the F-840s, those functional area 40s that I mentioned within the Army formations, the Marine Corps and the Navy are also establishing space professionals. I think the MSOs, the maritime space officers within the Navy, have somewhere around 80. The Marines building their formation upwards of about 40 people that are, you know, space savvy, joint enabled. But I think what you're leading to as far as a liaison officer can really be done at the Space Force element level. And what I mean by that is, I'll just give an example from Space Delta 3 that's focused on EW. As far as SPA 4 Gen, so the Space Force presentation of forces to command commands, you have a combat squadron, and you've got operators, you've got intel, you've got cyber. One of those elements is a mission planning cell. And so if a specific command, or more likely at an operational level, so, you know, if the KOC or the TOC or the JOC level, if you needed that capability to do the integration across all your space capabilities and capacity within the command, there is that lever to press to get that mission planning cell with the right expertise to do the integration and synchronization of joint fires with the knowledge specifically of Space Force capability to protect and defend and to enable movement and maneuver, while also understanding the deconfliction process so we make sure we don't frat each other out and have effective mission is there. I mean, it's built into the SPA 4 Gen cycle. And so before we try to recreate too many processes, maybe we should let that process evolve and mature a little bit. Again, get some sets and reps enough.
Well, yeah, you know, I do want to ask that, you know, and you started to mention it, but, you know, deconfliction with EW in a traditional sense comes with a lot of planning. So is this different in space? And, you know, because I'm imagining that some EW efforts that, you know, maybe we're using in the air domain or on the ground could bleed over to assets that might affect you, and you need to plan for that as well.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that is accomplished through existing processes, whether that be through a spectrum manager or the J6 in a different command or component level. Through the IC as you get your approvals and things like that for an intel gain loss as far as deconfliction. It is going to get more challenging as more capacity gets brought on board and more fruitful targets become available if we went into conflict. But that doesn't withstand the process that exists that could hopefully, and through exercises and rehearsals, could be able to scale up to account for that.
Yeah, this is Shocker. I would say also there's opportunities. I think those capabilities, both in the space and air domain, are complementary. And I would almost even bring ISR into the discussion a little bit and say, if we're properly integrating, we're planning properly, we could have EW effects that optimize ISR collection. So that those kinds of things, thinking through before a campaign, or certainly we do that on the red side amongst the aggressor, different aggressor units. To try to optimize those kinds of things. So there's a lot of opportunity there, a lot of goodness.
So where do you expect space EW to evolve over the coming decade? And what part of that is tied to technology and what is tied to the art of enhanced CONOPS?
All right, I see several measures as far as we evolve the EW enterprise. The first one, because of solid investments by the Space Force, we're going to see those dividends on EW capabilities, as well as capacity going into the future to counter the ability for our adversaries to do that space-enabled attack. Also, we've largely, as a Space Force, and I would say as a U.S. nation, really been focused on kind of the, if you use a Navy comparison, the brown water Navy, the littorals. And what I mean by that is we've really been focused at geosynchronous looking inward. And where I see an evolvement is as the enterprise, space enterprise evolves to cislunar and beyond, there is going to be a requirement to do EW, whether it be attack, support, or protection on our spacecraft, whether that be manned or unmanned in those cislunar missions. So the big evolution I see in the enterprise is seeing those dividends in the Space Force investments as far as capability and capacity, and us naturally moving towards a Navy blue water model with cislunar and beyond.
Hey, absolutely. And I appreciate the opportunity to highlight kind of the growth of the space aggressors into the future here. So we've talked throughout the podcast about the traditional mission of the aggressors with GPS, EA, SATCOM, EA, and ASN. But again, we're charged with replicating our near-peer adversary threats. And that's one thing that we are really deliberate about right now is modernizing our replication capability so we can be that realistic sparring partner for blue forces. So our job in the aggressors is to know, teach, and replicate the threat. That's all rooted in intelligence and an assessment of what the adversary capabilities are. And then our job is to try to mirror that as much as possible. Sometimes that's specific systems, but more often than not, it's the effects of those systems. So in addition to our traditional mission areas, we've talked about growth with cyber aggressors. We're also exploring directed energy weapons, SAR jammers, LNS band jammers. So some types of threats that up to this point, we've traditionally just taught and given academics on, but we haven't been able to replicate live. So we're really exploring those capabilities, as well as from a modeling and sim perspective, a digital threat environment so that we can replicate, let's say, systems that have irreversible effects or systems that we may have because of policy difficulty doing over a live environment, if that makes sense.
Yeah, Shocker, that's great to hear that you're trying to keep up with the adversary and replicating their threat capabilities. But, you know, just from my assessment of how adversaries are moving out so quickly on their own threat capabilities, that can't be an easy job for you. So my hat's off to you and your entire team for moving out on that. And I was really glad to hear from Trigger's perspective, the growth in capability and capacity over time. And yeah, it's, you know, Cislunar is one of those things that I see us merging out into in the near future, of course. And how we protect those signals is going to be critical. One thing I think is an area that a big question mark for me is, as we move to laser comms, are there ways that adversaries could try to interfere with those, and how do we replicate that? Or are there other means of communications between the ground and satellites that we need to be, you know, monitoring to ensure that they're protected? And then, of course, from the aggressor's perspective, just trying to keep up with that threat, like I talked about earlier, is a daunting challenge. So a lot to happen in the future with regard to space EW and protection of our capabilities against the growing threats. Thank you both.
Well, gentlemen, it's clear that space is an active warfighting domain. And again, it isn't anything that we wanted, but our adversaries voted. So here we are. We're grateful to have guardians like you both innovating and expanding our offensive and defensive capabilities in space to protect our global interests. So thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thanks, Slick, for the invitation to join you for a few minutes today. Again, Charles, good talking to you. And it's always good to join my buddy, Shocker, as we talk about this important enterprise.
Thank you for the invitation today. Charles, it was great to talk to you today. And to Colonel Fernango, it's always a pleasure to get together and have the opportunity to talk about our mission and our folks. And yeah, to get the word out to the general public. You know, I still run into folks who say things like, oh, the Space Force, is that actually a real thing? So having these kind of public-facing forums that give us an opportunity to talk about the tremendous impact that our folks are having on the Joint Force is an opportunity that we have to see. So I thank you very much again for the invitation today.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, thank you both and all of your team members for what you continue to do day in and day out. And Slick, it's always great to chat with you. So look forward to the next one.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to our guests for joining in today's discussion. I'd also like to extend a big thank you to our listeners for your continued support and for tuning in to today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hit that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment to let us know what you think about our show or areas you think we should explore further. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and you can always find us at mitchellaerospacepower.org. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Stay safe and check six.